Welcome to the Tech Policy Podcast. I'm Evan Schwartzdrucker. On today's show, fake news and the election. The surprise result in this election has caused a lot of finger pointing, and many in the mainstream media and disgruntled Democrats have pointed the finger at fake news. Is it possible that the proliferation of fake information, particularly on Facebook and other social media sites, could actually swing the election? Joining me to discuss this is Will Reinhart, Director of Technology and Innovation Policy at the American Action Forum. Will, thanks for joining the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, before we begin, I know we work in the same field, but I feel like I see you at basically every single event that I go to these days,
of course,
and it's
yeah.
kind of creepy. So okay. Do you care to explain yourself on the show before our listeners?
We're in the same space. We do generally the same things. I used to work at Tech Freedom, so I'm kind of interested in the same topics. So it kind of makes sense, right?
But every single one.
I don't think that it's every single event. I'm going to start counting. I'm going to start counting the events that I go to that I do not see you.
Well, I'm going to write a fake news story about you being a creeper and following me around to events. Well, anyway, so Will.
It's a small world. It really is a small world in tech policy world. I mean, you see people consistently.
Yeah, a lot of nerds, a lot of Star Wars fans.
That's true.
Yeah, everyone's seen it. Everyone's arguing
about it. I have not seen it yet.
Yeah. Oh, God, you're terrible at being a
nerd. I know. I've had to work.
Yeah, well, your lack of Star Wars fandom maybe cast aspersions on the data you present today.
I'm more
today.
Of a Star Trek guy yeah. anyway.
Yeah, so. Your research is now under scrutiny. But anyway, Will, let's just ask the obvious question, right? Mm-hmm. Is it possible that something like fake news, which many have said has proliferated on Facebook, especially due to this negative election season, mm-hmm. is it possible that that's what tipped the election to Donald Trump?
I'm unconvinced of that, primarily because when we actually look at the effects of fake news, first off, it's really, really hard to figure out how extensive fake news actually is within social networks, and really what is fake news? Like, what do we define as fake news?
But there are some obvious examples, right? I mean, like this whole Pizzagate thing was just nonsense. The idea that there was a child sex ring being run out of a pizza shop in mm-hmm. D.C. And then that whole, on the other side of things, something that made Trump look bad, where it was a fake quote from him from People magazine from the 90s that said, if I ever did run for president, I'd run as a Republican because those people are idiots and they'd believe anything, which actually was just written by someone who believes that that is what the election was all about. It wasn't actually something that Donald Trump said. So yeah. there are some obvious cases of
True.
Fake news.
Yes, you're exactly right. There are some clearly misquoted items or things that just are clearly not true.
Yeah.
The Pizzagate issue is kind of interesting because that actually was much more focused on Reddit, and it largely came out of Reddit and a number of discussion forums within Reddit. So that's a bit of a different question.
But we're talking about Facebook.
Yeah, true. We're talking about Facebook. But generally speaking, when you look at these big events, especially voting, that people have pretty durable political beliefs, and so they're, you know, even though people say, oh, you know, I'm a swing voter, we see, you know, often it's talked about that, you know, the swing voters can push the election one way or another. When you actually really look at it, individuals are pretty consistent in who they vote for. So they may say that they're independent, but when it really comes down to it, they statistically speaking, they vote either for Democrats or Republicans down the ticket pretty consistently every single time. So they may think that they're actually open-minded, but people are very consistent in their views, especially when it comes to political views. I don't think that's a bad thing at all. It's that shows us that political opinions are important. But similarly, a lot of people aren't actually going online to talk about these items either. So it's just not it's something that people don't very consistently speak about online. Most individuals that are, you know, kind of in within the middle, you know, the moderate middle that you might consider, those individuals really aren't going online to talk about politics in any real meaningful way. And in fact, what they're doing on Facebook is, you know, clicking on cat videos and you know, looking at videos and pictures from their family and from their friends and commenting on you know, on entertainment and sports. That's far more common, at least from what we know about Facebook and what we know about Twitter, than anything else. And in fact, there was like a couple of years back, there was a really interesting study that it looked at a whole bunch of Twitter profiles and tweets and said, you know, something like, you know, about a fourth of all tweets are useless babble. But when you actually look at it, researchers call useless babble is actually this term called phatic communication. So people will often criticize Facebook and Twitter for, you know, I'm just telling about how I'm eating a sandwich right now. You know, I just tweeted out, I just ate a sandwich.
President of Tech Freedom, Baron Soka, loves to complain about phatic communication.
He does. The perfect
example being whenever it's someone's birthday at our office, mm-hmm. we use Slack to communicate internally. Mm-hmm. And someone will say, happy birthday. And then the next 9 employees will say, happy birthday.
Yep.
And then the interns from last year chime in. And the adjunct fellow adds his happy birthday. And then Baron will post a Wikipedia link to phatic communication.
Exactly. Which is what I brought this up to him when this study came out in 2009. Yeah, right in 2009. It was by Pear Analytics, as I recall. And it's exactly this point, is that people... So what phatic communication really is that we use communication to connect with individuals. And oftentimes we just say things just to say things such that we can get a response back from individuals. It's not like we're trying to impart information. It's not like we're trying to influence individuals. That's actually very... That's not very common. Even when you look at, you know, Pew survey data on Facebook, people aren't really going online to talk about politics very extensively. So this obviously.
But what about a less political example? And I'll tell you what I mean. Something like crime is on the rise, right? That could influence an election. That's not necessarily a political thing. I mean, Republicans might sometimes be seen as tougher on crime and Democrats less so. But really, there's a bipartisan consensus that, you know, drugs are bad, criminals are bad, whatever. Mm-hmm. And when Donald Trump said, falsely, that crime was on the rise, that is a fake statistic.
Mm-hmm.
A major candidate for office is saying it. And there were at least a significant enough amount of Democrats that voted for Donald Trump in some of these blue-collar states that was important in the election. So could something like just that fake information proliferating be important, even if people aren't that political or using Facebook constantly for politics? Anyone would care about crime increasing, regardless of your politics. And if you think Donald Trump's the one who's going to solve that, that fake item might be important. What do you think about that?
Well, the other side of this is that individuals often switch their viewpoint about national policies depending on which person that they're supporting. So in a very kind of series of very well-known experiments, individuals were surveyed beforehand to figure out generally how they believed on these type of topics, for example, crime statistics. And then they heard their preferred candidate talk about, you know, the policy position that would have been opposite to, you know, their original position when the experiment started. And then after the experiment was finished, it was found out that those individuals basically moved towards their preferred candidate. So instead of the crime statistics necessarily influencing an individual, an individual will already have a proclivity for, say, Trump or Hillary, and then they will then change their beliefs a bit in order to update, in order to come closer to their preferred candidate. So you still have this kind of durability of political psychology. Like the politics is a fairly durable thing for individuals, and they actually move a bit towards their preferred candidate. They don't actually, the policy positions really aren't, you know, as much as the wonks in Washington, D.C. and, you know, in Silicon Valley care about policy. It really actually isn't something that most people care about on a day-to-day basis.
If you want an example of this, you know, to tie this to the current political climate and this election, there's an article on Vox right now about Republicans' views of Vladimir Putin. And it's fascinating, right? I mean, you go back a few years before Donald Trump was the phenomenon that he is today and the president-elect, and Republicans hated Vladimir Putin, right? It's Russia stinks. Mitt Romney in 2012 said Russia's our number one geopolitical foe. Obama basically laughed at him in the debate and said the 1980s want their foreign policy back. I mean, look where we are today. Things are obviously very different, but that's something right there where the Republicans have accepted Donald Trump, they voted for him, and then because of that, they decided to change their opinion about Vladimir Putin. On the flip side, Democrats who were less negative towards Putin, way more skeptical of a war with Russia and way less, you know, they didn't like that harsh rhetoric towards other countries, even a country like Russia. They were just more dovish when it came to foreign policy. And now they were virulently anti-Russia during the campaign. They're pissed about the hack. They're angry at Putin. So those are examples of issues where people morphed into their candidate rather than, you know, held their candidate accountable for a view that contradicted theirs. And just look at Republicans on free trade. Traditionally, Republicans were very pro-free trade. Now you've got Mike Pence saying the free market is working and America's losing every time. So I mean,
this happens pretty consistently when one individual of a political party gets into office, and then, you know, so the classic example is that I believe in when Clinton got into office, the belief about how well the economy was doing and the changeover from Bush to Clinton actually among Democrats flipped. You know, they thought the economy was doing much worse, you know, on average, and then it flipped the opposite way. So now that, now the Republicans actually thought the economy was doing worse, or they were more worried about the economy as compared to everything else.
Yeah, even though many of these economic forces happen outside of who is the president. I mean, it might shock people to know that business occurs outside of politics, and presidents like to take credit for the economy or get blamed for the economy. But a lot of that is just forces outside of their control.
That's partially the point, is that presidential candidates, as kind of being this figurehead of political political parties, they get both blamed blame and praise for whatever's happening in a variety of issues. So the reason why this is important, obviously coming back to fake news, is, you know, will a piece of fake news, if it were to be fake, actually sway one person who is in the middle one way or the other? And I don't think that there's a lot of really, really good evidence that it will sway political voting behavior in a massive way. And in fact, you know, some of the reports, some studies about this have shown that this doesn't seem, that if there is an impact, it's very, very, it's very time sensitive. So it may only occur, you know, the view of how it changes an individual, like, you know, you have fake news about something horrible that happened that Clinton had done, that only seems to, in many cases, that only seems to be durable for maybe a couple days. And then afterwards, like, people kind of forget that news.
All right. So you make a good case that fake news does not have the power to, nor did it swing the most recent presidential election. However, that's not the only reason to be concerned about fake news, right?
Yeah.
This election was characterized by partisanship and negativity.
Yes.
And a lot of people voted for their preferred candidate because they hated the other candidate, not because they liked their own candidate, right? Mm-hmm. That's a phenomenon that is just, that's out there. So, to, you know, in that vein, Facebook has been criticized for creating filter bubbles.
Yes.
Where, so outside, like, and it's related to fake news, right? You're mm-hmm. more likely, the argument goes, to believe a fake news story if it conforms to your bubble, and then you would reject a fake news story if it was against your bubble. And does the algorithm play a role here? And this algorithm, the newsfeed algorithm, gets a lot of criticism for being some type of black box that no one understands.
Yeah.
And advertisers will complain about it for business reasons, but political people will complain about, I can't get my videos to trend. I can't get people to share my stuff. It must be a conspiracy. It's run by liberals. It's run by conservatives, whatever your conspiracy theory is. Mm-hmm. But does the fact that I like all these things on Facebook that agree with me, and then I get more of that kind of content back, the algorithm spits more, you know, libertarian stuff at me if I'm a libertarian, does that create partisanship? Does that worsen the divides in this country? Is Facebook just a confirmation bias, a filter bubble? What do you think about that? And does that make fake news more effective?
So there's a lot that
I know. You're just laying out a lot.
But
you're a smart guy. Yeah. You can keep up, right?
No, of course. I think, hopefully I can. There's obviously a lot embedded in the question you just asked. One thing that we do know, and I think that this is really important to remember, is that what social media actually allows individuals to do, so sites like Twitter and Facebook, they actually allow individuals to connect with people that they necessarily wouldn't be able to connect with in the past. So, you know, I mean, cousins and acquaintances, people from high school, 20 or 30 years ago, it was very hard to keep up with those individuals. It was actually very hard to maintain a personal relationship with those individuals. Now it's far easier to do that. You have a variety of sources, specifically that are given by social media and by, you know, by Facebook and by Twitter, to connect to those individuals and to learn what they're doing, but also to get information from them. And the reason why this is important is that network theory, which is largely what we're talking about here, and this is actually what I went to school for, and this is an area that I'm very, very interested in. Network theory was actually started because of this exact question, is where do individuals actually get their information? And so one of the classic studies in this is a study by a guy named Mark Granovetter, and he actually asked, okay, you know, where do you get information about a job offer? Where is it that you figured out about, you know, your job? And what he figured out, or, you know, looking at individuals and how they connect with each other, he found that people typically get their job through what are called weak ties. So it's people you don't consistently talk to.
You always hear that. Like a friend of a friend got me the job, or, oh, I met a guy at a party once, but like, he's not my best friend. But it still resulted in me getting a job.
And it's, so Facebook allows you to maintain more of those relationships. And what that means is that information and novel information, specifically things that you wouldn't necessarily have heard if you only maintain like a closer social circle, that Facebook and Twitter allow you to they allow you to gather information from those novel information sources. So that's at core, what these sites allow us to do is really to maintain a larger surveillance of our social networks and to build out social networks. And this has been found pretty consistently. Even, you know, Facebook data has found this. Other researchers have found this. Some very well-known network theorists have found this as well. And similarly, what they found is that individuals, especially when it comes to the news sources, that social media, of course, isn't the only place you're going to, you know, going to get news. You know, it's this often cited statistic that, you know, the individuals get about 62% of their news from social media.
Well, also, it's also the advertising thing, right? Like Google and Facebook are dominant players in online advertising. So even if they're not necessarily the place where the news is consumed, they're so important to the equation that people do get worried about what Facebook and Google are doing, because they think that those two companies have a massive influence over what information gets disseminated, because you can't make money unless you work with those two. I mean, is there a fairness there? Is it fair to criticize these companies for the proliferation rather of fake information because they are so dominant in terms of the economics of online advertising?
Could you unpack that a little bit more? I mean,
like the idea that you can't make it, right? Like you're as a newspaper, as an online newspaper, right? The Guardian has griped that it's lost $20 million. I mean,
yeah,
you can cite all sorts of statistics about the changing media landscape, but does Facebook have an added responsibility? And that this gets to the whole question of, is it a tech company? Is it a media platform? Is it a newspaper?
Yeah.
Do they have an added responsibility? So even if you say people get their information from other sources, those sources might not exist if not for Facebook ad revenue or Google ad revenue.
True. And so the reason I wanted a little bit of clarification is because there are a whole bunch of different sites that have different sorts of models and that have different sorts of kind of legacy models in place.
Yeah, like if you still do a print edition.
Yeah. Yeah. So I mean, but newspapers are kind of a different beast altogether. So when you look at newspapers, even though consistently it's said, oh, you know, social media is where most people go to get their news, that actually isn't the case. And the reason I was bringing up this statistic is that individuals get news from a whole bunch of variety of sources. So I actually looked at a number of the large newspapers, and most recently, a lot of the large newspapers get about 15 to 20% of their referrals. So where do individuals actually go before they're going on a news site? You know, 15 to 20% of individuals on a desktop are actually coming from social media, and primarily Facebook. But on the opposite side, when you look at the rest of the referrals, where do people go before they go to a news site? They typically go to Google and they search and they do a direct search, like, okay, I want to see what's going on in the news today. I'm going to the Washington Post. So I'm going to go into Google. I'm literally going to look up Washington Post, and then I'm going to go and click on the very first citation. That's typically how individuals interact with news. And in fact, when you look at actual news patterns, that seems to be far more consistent than anything else. So individuals will go to a variety of sources. They'll typically go to Yahoo News, and then they'll click on, you know, news from there, which is a conglomeration, or it's an aggregation service rather. They'll go to Google News, again, an aggregation service, but all of those are branded. So each of the different sections, you understand exactly where you're going to. So that's at least a number of researchers have tried to look at actual research. Or I'm sorry, have actually tried to look at actual news consumption. And that seems to be much more consistent. But we also have to remember there's other places as well to advertise, and also to, you know, well, largely speaking, there's other places to advertise. So, you know, newspapers obviously are are having some trouble and are struggling, but there's still radio, there's still local TV, there's still cable television, and there's still
YouTube.
There's still YouTube. There's still other sources that individuals could go towards in order to get information, and they do go in order to get information. So
that just casts doubt on the notion that we have to solve this problem at this one company because that company controls everything, right? Like just the hysteria over, if Facebook can't solve fake news, then there is no hope, right? There's no hope for democracy. We can't agree on a basic set of facts. And if we can't agree on a basic set of facts, we can't argue intelligently mm-hmm. about how to develop policies to address those basic facts. There's another issue here, right? People can make money off of fake news. I mean, that's yes. part of the big criticism is that the architecture of Google and Facebook did not prevent people from making money. Mm-hmm. And I would encourage people to listen to a relatively recent episode of Planet Money, a NPR podcast, where they tracked down one of these people who made a career out of this. The irony is that he was stoking, at least he claims, he was stoking the fires of the alt-right to undo Trump, right? He thought that by exposing the worst elements of his constituency, you know, the deplorables, as Hillary Clinton called them, that that would destroy Trump. I mean, Democrats thought this too, right? They thought, how could anyone vote for someone when there's all these horrible people who support him, you know, racists, whatever. That's the irony. So he was a Hillary Clinton supporter, but made a bunch of money off of fake stories with Trump. But is that a problem? Is that incentive? So maybe right now your research shows that fake news is not as big a deal as we say, because one, people aren't getting all their news from social media, and two, people don't only go to social media for politics. Those are compelling data points. But what about the potential for future problems? If there's a case mm-hmm. study here, how to make money, write ridiculous articles that are complete nonsense that result in some weird stuff happening like Pizzagate, mm-hmm. You can make money. I mean, yeah. Is that a problem?
So this has clearly been an issue that this has long been an issue. So this largely, I would put a lot of this largely within this issue of spam, and primarily this has been a problem that marketers and advertisers have long criticized Google and Facebook. And in fact, they spend both Google and Facebook and Twitter and YouTube spend a lot of time trying to deal with these type of spam issues. So, you know, I largely put this in a broader conversation that has existed for some time now about this back and forth between individuals and individuals getting content and then content being created specifically in order to game the system. I mean, that's how Google actually became one of the major players in search, is that they had a better search algorithm. They had a better method of classifying important data as compared to everyone else, because everyone else was just using links or not using links. And what Google was able to then come in and do was able to basically create a citation mechanism in order to look and see what the structure of the internet was a little bit better. The point is that this, the spam and spam fake news, at least as you're talking about it, specifically to just kind of generate content, is consistently an issue that both sides fight back and forth about.
Yeah, and I mean, that's important to point out, right? I mean, spam existed before Facebook, fake chain emails, you know, fake pharmaceutical, right? The incentive to make money off of false information on the internet was not invented by Facebook. This is just the news element might be more recent, right? The idea yes. that people can set up a website that is usatoday.com.co, mm-hmm. abcnews.com.go, and then that means it's fake. But if you're not a savvy internet user, maybe you fall for it. But that it's just the latest iteration of a longstanding problem, which is false information. And it goes back, yeah. as I talked to Barron, we did an episode about this. It goes back to elections from the 1820s and the 1870s. Yeah. And we've had nasty elections. We've had fake information. We've had newspapers completely tied to political parties.
Yep.
This whole idea of objective journalism, this was invented by, you know, journalists after World War I. It's not mm-hmm. a longstanding yes. concept in human history
yep.
to have unbiased news. So really, this is not necessarily as novel as people think it is. What do you think about Facebook's response? Right? You just mentioned that the companies are all, they're on the case. They've got people working on it.
Mm-hmm.
Facebook last week came out with a post about what it's doing, and you've got easier reporting. People can, you know, flag a story, third-party fact-checking. They're going to integrate things like Snopes and PolitiFact into the platform. There are people who think those are just liberal sources, but I use them to debunk stories before. Visually marking a disputed story, right? Having some type of indication when you get that box in your newsfeed with the news story. And then just reducing spam. That's the attempt at getting rid of the financial incentive to just put these people out of business. What do you think about this response?
So generally speaking, I think that you know, companies have been proactive in trying to deal with what they perceive as a problem here. The real question is how effective it's going to be. And there, I haven't seen a lot of really good research on just how effective it's going to be, how effective this problem will be, because obviously this is just a very new problem. When you look at other similar sorts of studies that have tried to update misinformation, what you find, especially recently, a kind of a well-known political scientist named Brendan Nyhan actually did a study exactly on this issue. So we were talking a little earlier about the crime statistics for Trump. And so he actually went back to individuals and, you know, and asked them, okay, you know, Trump made a statement about crime statistics, which wasn't necessarily true. It might have been true for 1 year, but it wasn't necessarily true for
manipulated.
Yeah. I would say it's probably framed incorrectly, at least on Trump's side. But when you actually look at then individuals who are then given new information and were told, you know, over the last decade, crime has generally gone down over most large American cities, that when they were then given this updated information about crime statistics, they in fact did change their beliefs about what had happened about crime. But the other ancillary effect is that they actually trust the trust in crime statistics went down. So their trust in the system itself actually went down. And so this is the very interesting part of this entire conversation, which is that when you do debunk something, if people actually do believe that their misinformation has been corrected, if they actually do update their information, are now correct in their beliefs, they still actually typically will trust the information source less.
And so even if I accept that you were right this time, right? Like, okay, yeah, you might be right this time, Will, but in general, I am now going to doubt more.
Bingo.
The crimes. And speaking of perverse incentives, I wanted to ask you another thing earlier, you know, counterintuitive. After the election, we saw a lot of people just in shock because the predicted result did not happen. Mm-hmm. And many in the mainstream media who had called 99% chance for Hillary, you know, 80% chance, whatever it was, who just thought it was a done deal, they were in shock too. And I saw all this kumbaya right on CNN, like, you know, we just need to listen to each other more. Like, things have just gotten really heated. And I just think we all need to just kind of like listen. And really, it's a call for bursting your bubble, getting more sources, liking a source that you disagree with, and having more friends on Facebook with opposing views. And we all accept this as a benefit. We all assume that expanding your bubble, that being exposed to more opinions is a good thing. Mm-hmm. Yet in the article I read that you wrote, which is linked to in the show notes for today, anyone cares to read some drivel that Will wrote.
wow.
Which I enjoyed it. But you said in that article that actually if you expose yourself to more opinions, you expand your bubble, you bring in all that information, all it does is reinforce existing beliefs. How is it possible that this thing that we all assume is good, expand your bubble, listen more, kumbaya, how is that bad?
I wouldn't necessarily say it's bad.
Well, ineffective.
That's the point, is that the question is, the bigger question is, how do we change individuals' beliefs? And one, do we really want to be toying with individuals' beliefs like that?
But we want a better discourse, right? That's a goal. Like, we don't necessarily want people to change their philosophy, to change parties, to change their ideology. What we want is something better than this past election cycle, which I think we can agree was pretty nasty.
Yes, it was. I would say it was. It was very political.
So if we want a healthier discourse, we want more bipartisanship. Mm-hmm. Is there, like, how is it possible that actually exposing ourselves to more viewpoints is not going to fix that?
Well, I think we need to step back just a second, at least on some of the assumptions that are built in here. One of the assumptions that I think is clearly built in is that most people think that partisanship has gotten more extreme over the years. And while this may be the case in Congress, while there may be a sorting out of, you know, on both sides between liberal Republicans and more conservative Democrats, each side kind of going, you know, towards the opposite side. And there's clearly been
like a purge, really. I mean, there's fewer blue dog Democrats, they call them, and there are fewer moderate Republicans, right? The idea that they've kind of solidified their ranks much more in a parliamentary style system.
Indeed. And so when you look at that, that probably is the case. So there is a lot of really good evidence in a number of different sources for this. But when you actually look at the American populace, it doesn't that type of partisanship on both sides doesn't really seem to be occurring that much. So over time, people really haven't gotten more partisan. And in fact, this is why you can have such dramatic swings on some issues very, very, very quickly, is because there actually is far more conversation that's going on. So most typical conversations about politics, again, it's not really happening online. It's happening kind of in these ad hoc places where people—
water cooler, locker room.
Yeah, or, you know, it, you know, randomly at a restaurant where an individual will kind of gather something politically that they didn't really expect before. So it's the spaces, the people expect that political conversations have to be in formalized spaces, and in fact that it'll be in a formalized space like Facebook, but or Twitter. But that's that. I don't think that that is necessarily what we should be achieving. So there, it could be the case that individuals again. So I'm going to probably leave it at there at least for the research. But I think that really what we need to think about is, how, again, the question you've asked is, how effective will it be? And again, the case is that we do know that individuals, whenever they're presented with new information, typically retreat to their own side, and they typically try to find, you know, the larger research area is called motivated reasoning, because individuals are motivated to find a reason for the things that they believe. So whenever you present them with new information, then they are motivated to find a reason, a way, and around whatever that new
presented information. Yeah, let me find a link that contradicts your link, and then Bingo. We've canceled each other out, and no one's progressed any more towards the other person's opinion, right?
Indeed.
So I guess we'll leave it there. My guest has been Will Reinhart, Director of Technology Policy at the American Action Forum. Will, I hope to see you at many more DC events. All of them. Literally every single one I go to. So,
thanks for having me on.
You have any fun plans for the holidays?
I'm driving across the United States.
The
entire United States. No, the upper Midwest. So
you're going to stop in Chicago? Speaking of crime statistics.
Chicago.
Yeah, there you go. Chicago.
Yep.
Hot dogs.
Yeah, good times.
All right. Well, follow us on Twitter and Facebook at Tech Freedom. Let us know what you think of the show. Send us an email at media@techfreedom.org. Find this podcast in the iTunes store, where you can leave us a review, because it will help others find the show. Thanks for listening.
Tech Policy Podcast is produced and distributed by Tech Freedom, a nonpartisan, nonprofit think tank in Washington, D.C. To learn more about our work, make a tax-deductible donation, or find other episodes, find us online at techfreedom.org.